is never like one who sells himself and then sets himself free. Now sure, you and I both, we kind of have to think twice about what was said. And to be honest, I think even if we think twice about it, it wouldn't make too much sense. And perhaps Imam Ali knew that what he just said was so profound that people like myself would not be able to understand. So then he continues and he gives a misdaq. He gives an instance of, he gives an example of this situation. He says, that is one who with praiseworthy deeds has redeemed himself from hell is never like one who, because of sins and blameworthy acts, has surrendered his soul to hell. We must be very careful, dear friends, and we must try our best to increase our praiseworthy deeds, and we must try our best to reduce the sins that we commit. And if for some reason we do end up committing sins, we should ask Allah, the Merciful, the Forgiving, to forgive us so that none of us, God forbid, have to be surrendered to hell. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. كل صبح وكل اشرب ايام تبكى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Yet importantly, when Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen was 12 or 13 years of age, the Quran reveals what says, وَأَنذِرْ عَشِيرَتَكَ الْأَقْرَبِينَ. Go and announce Islam now after 2 years or 3 years of relative concealment. Now it's time to announce. Amir al-Mu'mineen comes. The Prophet of Islam says to him, I'm going to invite Quraysh, the heads of Quraysh. I'm going to invite them in the house of your father Abu Talib. I'm going to ask you to cook for them. 40 people, 12, 13 years of age. Ya Ali, you go and prepare the food. This is found in Sunni and Shia narrations. Amir al-Mu'mineen at this tender age takes and seizes this opportunity. This responsibility given to him with honor. Bala, Ya Rasulullah, I will do it. He goes. The narration says Amir al-Mu'mineen is trying to prepare the food and the Prophet of Islam comes. Yes, he places some of his sacred saliva within the food and places his hands and stirs it. When the people came, the heads of Quraysh came, Ali ibn Abi Talib would serve them the food. At this young age, the food was not enough for 40 by looking at it. But they all ate, and the food would look as though it was untouched. And people gathered. Question, the Prophet of Islam giving this responsibility to a 12, 13-year-old, what does this mean to you and I? Ali ibn Abi Talib seizing this opportunity, what does it mean to you and I? It refers to the beautiful concept of initiative and giving responsibility. Meaning that the Prophet of Islam recognized that as far as youngsters and our youth is concerned, we need to empower them. We need to give them encouragement. We need to facilitate for them and tell them, go. Come on, you can achieve, you can become successful, you can serve, you can achieve greatness. When they feel this sense of belonging, when they feel a sense of dignity, Amir al-Mu'mineen felt this sense of honor that he was serving Rasulullah. When someone would come and praise him, he would say, Ana abdun min abidi Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. I am a servant from the servants of Rasulullah. This was the honor for Ali ibn Abi Talib. Today when we face these challenges that, for example, our youth face in many different places around the world, when they feel, or many of the communities feel, that they're not necessarily taking part, or they're not engaging, or they're not necessarily attending, or they're not interested in faith or taking part in the religion or activities associated with the religion, I guess one lesson we can take from this is that we have to facilitate and somehow encourage groups of our youth and individuals with potential to seize the opportunity and to build by providing them what is necessary in order to enhance themselves as well as activities within the community. I tell you, the Prophet of Islam utilized this throughout his holy life. You know, when it came to sending an individual towards Medina, who did he send? Mus'ab ibn Umair. Mus'ab was young. Mus'ab would belong to aristocratic family. Family which was very wealthy, selling perfume. Rasulullah said, you go to Medina, Yathrib, and invite people towards the religion. He was very young. He came into Medina. He started to read the Quran. Some say he was 20, 21 years of age. When he began to read the Quran, people walked past. They were mesmerized by the words of Allah. They became Muslim. Some of them threw themselves in the well so that they purify themselves before going home, because they said, we want to become Muslim right now. They were inspired by a young man. That's why the Prophet of Islam came to Medina. And it was prepared for him. The groundwork was started by a youth. And we see that even towards the end of the life of the Prophet of Islam, when he is about to leave this world, he has a huge army to go and fight the Roman Byzantines, to seek revenge over the death of many Sahaba and the battle of Mu'tah. So what does he do? He appoints a man by the name of Usama ibn Zayd ibn Haritha, the son of his adopted son. Yes, Usama ibn Zayd. He was 19 or 20 years of age. He says to him, you become the leader. To the extent that some of the companions were in their 50s and 60s, came to the Prophet and said, Ya Rasulullah, you're making a 20-year-old commander over us? I should be in charge. I am the one who's older. I am the one who's wiser. Prophet of Islam, according to Shahristani in Al-Milal wa Nihal, the famous book, yes, he comes and says what? He says, La'an Allah man takhallafa an jayshi Usama. Whomsoever does not go on the army of Usama, Allah's mercy is withdrawn from them.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Vital visits to look after people with dementia and other disabilities are being denied amid rising demand in the United Kingdom, including families concerned about sending their loved ones to care homes during the pandemic, and staff shortages triggered by low pay and Brexit. We now present you an article written jointly by Robert Booth and Maya Wolf-Robinson. The piece is titled, Operators Say Home Care Services Crisis in England at Worst Point Yet. Operators have warned services that look after the elderly and disabled at home are facing the worst crisis in memory, with hours of unmet care in England increasing more than fivefold since May to 1.5 million. Vital visits to look after people with dementia and other disabilities are being denied amid rising demand, including families concerned about sending their loved ones to care homes during the pandemic, and staff shortages triggered by low pay and Brexit. According to the Home Care Association, about half of domiciliary care providers are no longer able to take on new requests for help, and 85% of operators believe the situation is the hardest it has ever been. The charity Age UK has warned of the emergence of care deserts, a term more often applied to US healthcare shortages. The crisis threatens the welfare of some of the country's most vulnerable people and puts pressure on NHS beds, as people could be cared for in the community end up in hospital. Families told The Guardian that people feel imprisoned if carers are not available to take them outside, while their health is harmed because they forget to eat, they forget to drink or take medicine properly and on time. Jane Towson, the chief executive of Home Care Association, said, "Our strategy seems to be to neglect people in the community until they are in crisis, then blue light them into hospital." She added, "Then it is the devil's own job to get them out again because of a lack of capacity." The Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, ADAS, found that in the 3 months to the end of April, 286,000 hours of home care could not be delivered. By the end of October, that number stood at more than 1.5 million hours. Councils have managed to increase the number of hours delivered by 20% over that period, but it has not been close to enough. Stephen Chandler, The president of the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, ADAS, said, "These are not numbers, these are people's lives. Every single one is a person who is missing out on vital support that enables them to live their lives. The government must make immediate steps to ensure that everyone gets the care and support that they need this winter." Margaret McCann, an 81-year-old with dementia living alone in Brighton in East Sussex, is among those caught in the crisis. In June, she stopped eating and forgot to drink and take medication, and a crisis care team from Age UK stepped in temporarily until her family hoped a home care package from the local council could be arranged. 6 months later, the only professional care she receives is from the crisis team, which was supposed to stop after just 6 weeks. Her daughter, Sally McCann, who has a full-time job and a son aged 17 years, said, "She has dementia and lives on her own, which is a massive worry." She adds, "She is basically on her own and is losing all her social contact. It breaks my heart. The emphasis is on keeping everyone at home, but they will just deteriorate unless there is help." On a short visit recently, Margaret, who remains sprightly at times, held hands with her carer, Trevor Few, and told him, "I'm nearly 82 years old, you know." He asked, "What's your secret?" She said, "I've forgotten," adding, "I tell you next time you come." Brighton and Hove City Council said it has seen a fivefold increase in demand in the last year, with families increasingly reluctant to send their loved ones into care homes. It said Brexit has hit providers' attempts to find enough staff. Sue Shanks, the chair of Council's Health and Wellbeing Board, said social care services, including home care, desperately need more government funding quickly if we are going to continue to fully meet the needs of our residents. In Salford, in the city of Manchester, Charlie Pelham, an 86-year-old who is in wheelchair after four spells in hospital this year, and Eric Griffiths, a 57-year-old who is registered deaf and blind, said they both need home care packages, but that these have either been unavailable or unsuitable, leaving them to fend for themselves. Eric Griffiths said, "Imagine me being blind, pushing a wheelchair. I was crashing into bus stops and tipping him out into the road because I couldn't see what I was doing. I get Charlie ready and I'm doing all the shopping by myself, doing all the cooking and the cleaning. It's really hard, but what can you do? It's got to be done." John Merry of Salford City Council said, "There are challenges with the number of care workers. This is a national issue not unique to Salford, and we're working hard to bring in more service providers so there is enough resilience and capacity in care supply." In Leicestershire, Deirdre Thomas, a 68-year-old, helps look after her mother, Jean, but has been looking for evening care for 6 months. She said, "My mother, Jean, is 99 years old and pretty wobbly. My heart is in my mouth. I'm so terrified she will fall over. An ambulance won't come and I will never see her again." Caroline Abrams, the charity director of Age UK, said urgent action is required to even keep the system viable, adding, "For older and disabled people, the consequences of this crisis in care can be very severe." The Department of Health and Social Care said, "Care homes and home care providers are benefiting from hundreds of millions of pounds of investment in the social care workforce, including through a dedicated recruitment and retention fund. COVID-19 pressures are continuously kept under review, and the need for further support will be assessed as we go through the winter period."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, power. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of power and its impact on the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the word power in the Islamic context, we see that in the Islamic context, when it is said about the power, it means that a person who has the power, he lives with chastity, he lives with love, and the power means not to misuse the power that you have. The power means to use power under the surveillance of the justice, under the surveillance of the love. And the power in the Islamic text is used like when you can use your power to show others, it is where you're defending yourself. In the defense, you need to show your power, or for example, you need to show your power so that the enemies cannot attack you. They should know that you have your own rights, you have the power of defending yourself, and you have the power of eliminating any enemy that will attack you. Therefore, when we talk in Islam about the power, this power means that it's for your defense. So when you show your power, it is to defend yourself from the invasion of the others so that no one can invade your country, your house, your respect. And that's what, when we look at the Islamic text, we found these things under the topic of power. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of power under the context of Islamic teachings. And we see that in the Islamic lifestyle, when we talk about the power, this power does not mean oppressing others. This power does not mean to invade other countries. This power does not mean to misuse your ability or this power that you have. This means that you use your power in order to facilitate other people. We use, in Islamic lifestyle, we use power to facilitate other people, to help the oppressed ones, to help the needy ones, and to protect ourselves. This is what power basically refers in the Islamic lifestyle when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle. So even in many of the narrations, we have the same meaning. And also when we talk about the power in Islam, Islam says not to misuse the power, because if someone uses or if someone misuses the power, then obviously he is not following the true path of Islam. So someone should not use it as a trick. So we do not have the permission of using power or misusing the power. Let's say like this. We do not have the permission of misusing the power in order to show ourselves to the others. Therefore, it is very important. It is very important to follow the righteous path which is set in the Islam. And the ones who are following the Islamic lifestyle, who wants to have the Islamic lifestyle, remember, the power that Allah has given to you, it's a blessing. It is a trust which Allah has given you. So use it under the justice, use it with the justice, with the love, and for the sake of betterment of the society, and not to just something which you have personally or to show off yourself, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Resolution 194 enshrines the right of return of Palestinians displaced from their homeland, but the Zionist regime has ignored it. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Qada Karmi, former research fellow at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies, University of Exeter. This article is published under the heading, "The denial of the Palestinian right of return is a crime as great as the Nakba." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is that time of year when yet another anniversary of disappointed hopes looms over Palestinians. 73 years ago, on December 11, 1948, Resolution 194 was passed by the United Nations General Assembly. It was of enormous legal and moral significance, enshrining the right of return of Palestinians displaced from their homeland by the Zionist regime's creation, to return home or to be compensated for the loss of their property. Coming so soon after the mass expulsion of Palestine's population during the Nakba in May 1948, it seemed a perfect antidote to that disaster, offering a lifeline to devastated Palestinians. Resolution 194 has been reaffirmed by the UN every year since 1949, attesting to its continuing relevance, but it has never been implemented, thanks to the Zionist regime's ferocious opposition and Western inaction. From the outset, the UN, aware of the Zionist regime's anxieties about a refugee return, took pains to use careful language in its wording of the resolution. Its request for the Zionist regime to repatriate refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date can only be seen in that light, against the background of a clear international consensus on the absolute legal and humanitarian right of individual return, without condition or caveat. This was an extraordinary concession to the Israeli regime concerns. It set the stage for the subsequent tolerance of the Zionist regime's continued intransigence over the right of Palestinian return. The consequences have been hugely damaging to Palestinians. All the ills that have beset them since 1948 can be linked back to that denial of their right of return. Had it been allowed, there would be no Palestinian refugees. More than 5 million are registered with the UN today, or refugee camps, of which there are around 5,000. The UN Relief and Works Agency, set up specifically to care for Palestinian refugees in 1949, would never have existed. No Palestinian would have to endure the limbo of statelessness or be labeled terrorists for exercising their legitimate right to resist the Zionist regime's oppressive rule. Gaza would not be under an inhumane 14-year siege with no end in sight. Palestinians who sought refuge in their countries of exile would no longer have to be treated as burdens or second-class citizens. They would have retained their dignity and self-respect, save in the knowledge that they had a homeland of their own. Nor would Palestinians have suffered the psychological and social effects of exile, even harder to reverse than physical exclusion. What before 1948 had been a cohesive society with its own customs and norms was comprehensively smashed by the Zionist regime's establishment. Worse still, the Zionist regime then set about trying to erase all traces of the Palestinian presence in the land it had taken over. Hundreds of villages were demolished. Arabic place names were replaced by Hebrew, and a new Israeli narrative wrote Palestinians out of the country's history. The aspects of Palestinian culture not destroyed in this endeavor were appropriated as Israeli cuisine, embroidery, even the dabka dance. How can a people dispersed and fragmented around the world for decades return to this altered Palestine? In each place of exile, there have been changes in culture, customs, and lifestyle. Younger generations may identify more with their current surroundings than with Palestine. How will such desperate communities learn to live together again? Return has long been a common theme that united a dispersed people. But if they did return, what unifying idea would take its place? What sort of Palestine, with what type of governance and social norms, do returnees want to live in? Had Palestinians remained in their native land, they would never have faced these hard questions. Their society would have evolved naturally. Rebuilding a Palestinian society today, on the other hand, entails a huge task. Reversing the effects of an exile that need never have happened. The denial of the Palestinian right of return was a crime as great as the Nakba. It started with deliberate negligence with regards to the Zionist regime's admission to the UN in 1949.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Following the Holy Prophet in justice.
This is part of the speech delivered on October 24th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
با دشمن هم حتی بایستی شما با عدالت رفتار
Even an enemy should be treated fairly. So this is another task, and this is primarily our responsibility. Whatever decision you make and whatever regulation you make, whether in the Islamic Consultative Assembly, where you pass laws, in the government, or in various other positions of management throughout the country, one of the most important things you take into account should be the issue of justice. You should think, is this in accordance with justice or not? Sometimes it is necessary to prepare an attachment describing justice for that regulation so that it becomes clear that this regulation and law is being implemented in accordance with justice. This is the second point. However, if we wish to observe justice, it should be noted that justice is not just about the distribution of property and wealth. Justice and fair treatment should be witnessed in everything.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
امروز توی فضای مجازی انسان گاهی اوقات بی‌عدالتی مشاهده می‌کنه. خلاف میگن، تهمت میزنن، دروغ میگن. قول به غیر علم میگن اینا بی‌عدالتی است اینا نباید انجام بگیر
In the internet today one sometimes witnesses injustices they say untrue things they slander they lie they promise without knowledge these are acts of injustice and these things should not be done A person who works with the internet needs to watch over himself and those who control the internet need to be even more vigilant to ensure that such things do not happen We should learn and get used to treating people fairly.
حرف هم میزنیم شما ممکنه با یه نظری بد باشید او رو قبول هم نداشته باشید حیبی نداره نظر شماست ممکنه نظر درستی هم باشه اما این رو با تهمت با دروغ با اهانت با این چیزا نبایسته آلوده کرد
Even when you speak if you are not on good terms with someone and you do not share their viewpoint it is all right it is your opinion It may be the right opinion, but it should not be contaminated with slander, lies, insults, and the like. It is very bad to contaminate one's viewpoint with these things. These statements were about justice.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. Guided me from all the ways that were wrong
in the limelight.
President Biden is navigating a politically fraught path on climate change after last weekend's deadly tornadoes, stopping short on Monday, 13th of December, of directly blaming global warming for the disaster, but emphasizing the storm's extreme nature and ordering officials to get more definitive answers. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalist Sean Sullivan, Annie Linsky, and Scott Clement. The piece is titled, Biden Walks a Careful Line on Climate After Tornadoes. Stay with us for more. President Biden is navigating a politically fraught path on climate change after last weekend's deadly tornadoes, stopping short on Monday, 13th of December, of directly blaming global warming for the disaster, but emphasizing the storm's extreme nature and ordering officials to get more definitive answers. President Biden, facing an unusual series of violent weather events during his first year in office, has been forced to change the way presidents have long dealt with natural disasters. A task that once involved calling local leaders, offering aid, and consoling victims. All things that Joe Biden has done has expanded to far more politically sensitive terrain. Scientists are drawing clearer lines between global warming and destructive weather, often prompting Biden to warn of the urgent need to address rising temperatures. And some climate activists say the tornadoes underline the urgency of swift action. But Republicans are eager to pounce on any exaggeration of climate change's impact, putting pressure on Biden not to get ahead of what is verifiable. We have to be very careful. We can't say with absolute certainty that it was because of climate change, Joe Biden said on Monday, 13th of December, after officials briefed him on the tornadoes. But he added, "What is certain, it is one of the worst tornado disasters we've had in the country. And the second thing that's certain is that it is unusual. It is unusual how it happened, how many places it touched down, and the length of the path. So that's all I'm prepared to talk about right now." President Biden on Wednesday, 15th of December, plans to visit Kentucky, where tornadoes killed at least 74 people. At least 14 more were killed in other states. Kentucky leans heavily conservative and is the home of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a vocal critic of Joe Biden's climate agenda. Senator Mitch McConnell did not mention climate change in a floor speech on Monday on the tornadoes. President Biden said he has ordered the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, and other departments to delve more deeply into whether climate change is responsible for the tornadoes or contributed to their ferocity. Although the precise connection between climate change and tornadoes is not certain, experts have said that higher temperatures could intensify these violent storms. The recovery efforts come at a moment when climate change is at the center of Joe Biden's domestic agenda. He's trying to push a bill across the finish line on Capitol Hill that, among other things, would make historic investments in fighting climate change. His administration is also promoting a new infrastructure law that makes large investments in a vast network of electric vehicle charging stations. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to Maryland on Monday to focus attention on the administration's push to electrify the country's transportation system. "There can be no doubt the future of transportation in our nation and around the world is electric," Kamala Harris said. Without directly referring to the tornadoes over the weekend, Harris noted that a reason for the administration's urgency on climate is the extreme weather that is increasingly gripping the country, from wildfires to tornadoes to floods. Across our nation, rising sea levels are flooding streets, Harris said. Wildfires are burning out of control. Scientists and environmentalists describe climate change as an existential threat that could cause untold harm to humans and other species if far-reaching changes are not made fast. And Biden has made tackling this problem a centerpiece of his domestic and foreign policy blueprints. But Republicans are quick to criticize Biden's climate agenda as an overreaction to an exaggerated problem that will cost jobs and raise prices. Robert Stavins, director of Harvard University's Environmental Economics Program, said relying too heavily on extreme weather to make the case for climate mitigation can backfire, because opponents can point to stretches of fair or frigid weather to argue that action isn't needed. He recalled a Republican senator organizing activists to stand outside in Washington during a snowstorm with signs that read, "Honk if you think global warming is a hoax." One has to be very careful, in my opinion, of getting too far out in front of these claims, because it can come back to haunt you, Stavins said. For many years, presidents dealt with natural disasters as acts of God, spending little time litigating their causes and devoting most of their energy to dealing with the aftermath. But over the past decade, experts have been able to more definitively attribute the strength of the storms to changes in the climate, strengthening the hand of politicians who are urging policy changes, said Paul Bledsoe, who served as a climate advisor to the Clinton White House. "We didn't have that in the 1990s, when we were trying to warn the American public that this public safety crisis was coming," said Bledsoe, who is now a strategic advisor at the Progressive Policy Institute. Even during President Barack Obama's tenure, it was difficult to conclusively draw the connections between extreme weather events and warming temperatures, he said. Still, the science connecting tornadoes to climate change is limited, he said, which helps explain why Joe Biden has stopped short of attributing the recent tornadoes to the planet's warming. Nonetheless, a volatile issue has become part of the response to natural disasters, an area that had largely been free of politics. Biden in particular has sought to stress unity and empathy after such tragedies, but even his relatively limited statements on climate change in response to reporters' questions have drawn attacks from the right. On other occasions, Biden has been blunt, warning that the country faces a code red moment on climate. "We know that decades of forest management decisions have created hazardous conditions across the western forest, but we can't ignore the reality that these wildfires are being supercharged by climate change," he said in remarks after observing areas destroyed by wildfires earlier this year. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki stressed that many communities of all ideological stripes are affected by severe weather events fueled by climate change. But she signaled that Biden's visit on Wednesday would be more about providing comfort to those hit hardest by the recent tornadoes. "That visit is really about him receiving an update of the work that's happening on the ground, hearing directly from leaders on what they need more from the federal government, if anything," she said, adding, "He's not going to give a major speech while he's there." The president is also likely to stress the need to support the victims and their families. On Saturday, as news of the devastation was emerging, Joe Biden stressed the human cost to those who had lost their homes and worse. "My heart aches for those people right now, including the rescuers," he said. "Everything is gone, from the baptismal photograph to the wedding picture to the picture of your oldest daughter in a ballet, it's profound. Politicians like Biden are becoming more vocal about extreme weather, just as the public is expressing more concern. A September opinion survey conducted by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center showed that 67% of the American public said extreme weather events are happening more often than in the past, including majorities across all major regions of the country. A 2019 opinion poll from the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 63% of people who said their area had been affected by severe storms, droughts, or extreme hot days identified climate change as a major factor. Still, wider acceptance of the impact of climate change does not necessarily mean that Americans will back mitigation efforts in large numbers. Many Republicans, elected officials, and even some Democrats have resisted aggressive efforts to curtail emissions, arguing that doing so comes at the expense of workers in industries involving fossil fuels. Revving up the country's battle against climate change after 4 years under President Donald Trump, when the battle was largely abandoned, has been a central theme of Joe Biden's presidency. The climate challenge is one of four major crises he pledged to tackle upon taking office, along with the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, and racial justice. In February, the United States officially rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, a major international agreement from which Donald Trump had withdrawn. Joe Biden also took a leading role at a recent international climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Beyond that, climate has been a pillar of Biden's two highest-profile legislative packages, the infrastructure law that recently took effect and a social programs bill that he hopes to push through in the coming weeks. We all know everything is more intense when the climate is warming. Everything, Biden said on Saturday. He added, "And obviously it has some impact here, but I can't give you a quantitative read on that."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers gathered in Brussels on Monday for their final scheduled meeting of 2021. They accuse Moscow of massing troops near Ukraine's border in preparation for a possible invasion.
The ministers, all of them, have been very clear today that any aggression against Ukraine will come with political consequences and with a high economic cost for Russia.
Moscow denies it intends to invade Ukraine and accuses Kiev of Western-backed provocation. Many analysts say the EU's undying support for Ukraine is nothing short of scandalous. Just last September, the European Court of Auditors, the 27-nation bloc's financial watchdog, published a report showing that corruption in Ukraine is rife at the highest levels amongst politicians, the judiciary, and state-owned enterprises. The report states that since 2014, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission, but corruption reform efforts have failed. New sanctions against Russia being considered by the EU include travel bans and asset freezes targeting politicians. The Federation's banking sector could be hit. Perhaps the new gas pipeline between Russia and Germany might be blocked from becoming operational. The Kremlin has warned against further provocation. Despite all the rhetoric, analysts point out that the EU and Russia are major trading partners, particularly in the area of energy.
I think that very existence of this strong economic interconnectivity is encouraging to look for the ways for the better political relations.
Those relations are currently at an all-time low and will be the subject of much debate when EU leaders hold a summit here in the Belgian capital this Thursday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Prisoners' advocacy groups and prisoners' rights activists have held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons and detention centers. The sit-in, which took place inside the Red Cross office in Gaza, comes only one day after the Israeli regime renewed the administrative detention order of Hisham Abu Hawash, who has been on hunger strike protesting his administrative detention for nearly 4 months. Some 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli jails under administrative detention. Administrative detainees are incarcerated based on secret evidence without charge or trial for long periods of time.
Administrative detention has been an Israeli policy for decades in order to break the will of Palestinian prisoners. Israel, as an occupying power, used administrative detention to illegally hold thousands of Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. The apathy of the international community has encouraged the Israeli regime to violate the rights of Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners are kept in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities. They include women and children as well as elderly prisoners.
Currently, there are 39 female prisoners in Israeli jails, including 10 mothers. They also include sick and wounded female prisoners. The detention conditions inside Israeli jails are extremely bad, especially for women and children. Israeli prison guards target female prisoners and humiliate them all the time.
According to legal experts, Tel Aviv has long considered itself above international law and conventions due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States. Currently, around 4,500 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli custody under inhumane conditions.
At least 4,500 prisoners are held inside Israeli jails under horrible detention conditions. We demand that Israel be held accountable for its violations against Palestinian prisoners. Israel must treat Palestinian prisoners in accordance with the Fourth Geneva Convention and other international treaties regarding prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians. According to the latest statistics, Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Thousands of Palestinians are currently behind bars and languishing in Israeli prisons. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town,